There have been writers in history, I think almost all of us could name at least one, who've written a book, often it seems in a fairly short time, and then they just stopped. They never wrote another. For Janice Hash, the process may very well be reversed. Her first novel has been a long time coming. But now that she's finished it, well, for a start, she's already working on turning it into a screenplay. When she stopped by to drop off a copy of the newly available paperback edition of the book, I asked her if she'd read an extract for us. And then, as always happens when Janice stops by, we chatted for a while about her latest venture.
This is a section from Chapter 7. Then the legends of this village yield their fruit in clusters. Yaksali. Hannah Laurie was rehearsing the reading of Goodyear in her living room the night of the day after she'd last seen Alec. The rehearsal had to be in her living room because readings don't get a lot of rehearsal priority at a theater. And in fact, she preferred listening to her plays in a small space first, especially if she didn't know the actors well. Gave her a chance to find out about how they worked and provided a distinct psychological advantage. There were many actors who were much more cooperative on her turf than in the neutrality of the rehearsal studio. However, it had not been enough of an advantage this evening. She was arguing with Roberta, the actress reading Diana in Goodyear. "I don't think you have perspective. You're too close to it," Roberta was saying obstinately. "I wrote it, and I know how the character is reacting," Hannah Laurie retorted. Roberta shook her head and pushed her glasses back up the bridge of her nose. They were round, black, and owlish. She saw the character as an intellectual and was trying to dress the part. The reading was not going to be in costume. Hannah Laurie seriously doubted she needed glasses. Ever. After years in the theater, Hannah Laurie did not have a forgiving attitude towards actors' affectations, which are legion. "It's a very stylized play," Roberta insisted. "I think you have to play it that way. You have to develop a world in which the characters can exist." Hannah Laurie could just picture Roberta's acting teacher, who was also a famous cult religion guru, saying that in class. "It's just like farce. Play it straight and the style will come from that," she pleaded. "I agree with Hannah Laurie," said Howard, the actor playing the other role. Thank God Goodyear only has two characters, thought Hannah Laurie. "No one asked your opinion," snapped Roberta. Hannah Laurie put her foot down. "If you really feel you cannot read the part as I am directing it, I'll understand if you want to drop out," she informed Roberta. Roberta looked at her wide-eyed. Hannah Laurie was dead serious. She didn't have time for this, and frankly, Roberta was good, but not irreplaceable. Roberta said, much less aggressively, "Well, let's try it again, and I'll try to get more of the feeling that you want." "What I want is less feeling," Hannah Laurie pointed out. Roberta began again. "This was a part of Goodyear where the character is staring out the window at the LA skyline and speaking aloud. Hannah Laurie was already concerned it would be too voila la jeune beatnik." "It's like a vampire sucking the memory out of you," emoted Roberta, "so that you forget there was ever a life that was not like this, and you roll yourself into a little ball to protect yourself from the vampire Los Angeles," hear a catch in the throat, "proud that you have survived with your scars and your holes where something real used to be," a little sob, "forgetting it was everything but like this." A tear rolled down her cheek. The doorbell rang.
So much of this is drawn from life.
Yes.
You lived in Los Angeles.
That's right. That's right.
You have considerable experience in the theater.
That's right.
As a director and an actor, I think.
In the beginning.
Did this allow you to say some things that maybe you wanted to say when you were directing but couldn't?
Yes, definitely. Well, you know, the character of Hannah Laurie, the way I explain her is that in the very beginning, when I started writing the book, she did have many experiences that were drawn on my personal experiences. She lives in the same neighborhood that I lived in. She worked in retail, which I did for many years. She has a theater thing going on the side. But what I hope has happened is that she's become her own person. She sort of started out as a version of me, but now she's totally her own person. And she is much more fed up with actors than I ever was. I mean, she's really fed up with them.
I've heard writers say that before, and that has always fascinated me. Is that true that at some point the character becomes independent of you and And, you know, they say things like the character's talking back to me or the character wouldn't say that.
Yes, you know? Yes. I think that definitely happens. And it particularly happens if you're doing different drafts of the story or working on it, you know, over a long period of time, because you do start then envisioning the character doing something. It's not like, well, when I did this, it's like, well, because the character gets into all kinds of situations that you never got into ever. So putting yourself in that situation doesn't really help because you never did that. So all of a sudden, then it has to be a different life, somebody else's life.
And your character is an amateur private detective.
Well, she doesn't mean to be. You know,
she falls into it.
She sort of stumbles and she gets involved in this situation that is none of her own making. But she also doesn't disentangle herself from it either, you know, because she sees it as potentially good playwriting material. So that's how she gets involved in the first place. And then too bad for her because she can't get out of it at that point. She's stuck.
So where did you get that? Where did you get that material from? Is that purely out of your imagination? How did you?
It was out of my
imagination. Since it's so much outside your experience, how were you able to write about it?
The idea for the plot that sort of carries the story forward originally actually came from the background of it came from a story that I read in the LA Times, because I was searching for, I knew how I wanted the story to start, but I was searching for something that would be the plot line of that backstory, and I didn't have it. I didn't know what it was. Mm. And then I read this article in the Los Angeles Times that was talking about a real baby buying ring that was actually happening. And I thought, well, in that case, then this is perfect, you know, backstory for what's going on in this club, what's actually going on here, as opposed to what they say is going on. And so that made it really easy, actually, because I just created the story out of that.
And you did the research into that?
I did the research into it.
So you mm-hmm. learned how that sort
how
of operation works. And
how potentially it could work. And mind you, one of the things that happened since this story was being written over such a long period of time is you had to think back in time. You know, there were no cell phones. 9/11 had not occurred. So security measures at the airport were not as stringent. Things that these characters probably could have gotten away with, there's no way they could ever get away with them now. But the story is set in the mid to late 1980s. And so, again, you have to just say to yourself, well, okay, they had car phones, so the car phones are used. But, you know, the technology is completely different and the security things are different, so you have to adjust for that. It's pre-computers. There's no email. You know, there's no texting. And this is why some of the story does work. And when you look back at some of these older stories, you'll see they couldn't possibly work transposed to a modern, because people would just pick up a phone. You know, they'd have a phone in their pocket, you know, or they, you know, I mean, the communication would be so instant that all of these things would be solved. But because that didn't exist, that's one of the way the plot moves forward, is that people don't know certain things. You know what I mean?
Yes,
so,
I do.
Yeah.
So you sort of put yourself back in a previous incarnation of your own life.
Right. You do. You have to put yourself back and say, okay, what did I have and what did I not have? And, you know, just little bits and pieces. And you try, for example, and I imagine there may be some mistakes in this book, although I tried very hard. But, for example, you can't mention models of cars that didn't exist then. The airport in Korea that they fly into was a different airport because they built a new airport in the 90s. So I had to refer to the older airport as opposed to the airport that exists now. So you try not to have anachronisms.
So you did a lot of research on this.
I had to work on it for a while and go back and relook at things and say, well, you know, wait a minute now. I don't think that, you know, would have been referred to in that way during that time.
Give me some sense of the process then. So you begin by sort of mapping out your story.
Well, that is the way you actually should begin to do it. But that is not actually the way that I did it. You know, it's funny because I have to laugh because it's the same with the way that I developed as a journalist. You know, because most journalists, well, particularly if they're writing a long story, you know, a really long story, you know, there are going to be multiple drafts. There are going to be, you know, multiple revisions. I don't write that way. You know, I'm pretty much like stick it on the piece of paper and I'll think about it a little bit and maybe move a paragraph around here and there and that's it. I don't rewrite a lot. And for this book, I did have to do that to some degree, but I also didn't create it in the traditional way either. I did not write it backwards as some people do with mysteries. They figure out the ending first and then write backwards. I think Agatha Christie was famous for doing that. She would solve the mystery, and Conan Doyle did it, I know. They'd solve the mystery from the start and then they'd work backwards. I had no idea how I was going to solve all these problems. I really honestly didn't have the faintest idea. And then all of a sudden I'd get a bright idea like, I know, and would just, you know, work your way forward and figure it out as you go along.
And you didn't have any cohesion problems?
I did from time to time. And, you know, when I had someone edit the book after the first manuscript was done, I had someone edit it who was not a line editor, but was someone who was just reading the book as a whole and making certain suggestions. And she gave me some very solid things that she felt that I should go back and do, all of which were good. Every single suggestion she made was a solid, good suggestion. And I incorporated them all. But that came from, you know, her perspective of having not been that familiar with the story, because I didn't really see these problems. They didn't strike me as problems, but they did to her.
Right. So. Like somebody making a record, a producer's very handy. I was just having that conversation earlier. Mm-hmm. Certainly an editor's invaluable. Mm-hmm. Sometimes frustrating, sometimes very irritating, but
yeah,
pretty much essential.
Very much so. I'm very grateful to her because she helped me a great deal. She actually suggested, for example, the original manuscript was going back and forth between first person and omniscient narrator, which we've all read books where that happens. But she said, in this particular book, I'm finding it jarring that it's going back and forth, and I think you should rewrite the book so there is no first person at all. And I had to really think about that one, but then I accepted that suggestion. I rewrote the entire book and took out all first person. So there is just no, that doesn't exist anymore. So, and I think also, you know, it relates back to what we were saying before. At the time that I was doing the rewrite, I was able to let go of the first person because that character was no longer any aspect of me. She really had disappeared out of me into Hannah Laurie.
So. Right. So when you first started writing, it was probably almost like writing a diary.
Right. It was. You know, it was more, I'm just going to put my own thoughts down on paper. I'm going to write about my own neighborhood. Because the beginning part of it is pretty much literally, if you had looked out my window, that's what you would have seen. None of that was made up. But then, as I say, she lives there too.
That's right. But because you did it that way, it has a somewhat cinematic quality. You can see it, you know?
Yeah.
Because you're describing it so well and so pictorially.
Yeah. And actually, we are, a friend of mine and I, are developing the book into a screenplay.
The book is called The X Club Tong Pang. Janice Hash will be signing paperback copies at the Winder Binder Gallery on Fraser Avenue this Saturday, January 18th, from 2 until 4. Robin Seaman, the local graphic artist who designed the cover, will also be at Winder Binder Gallery to sign copies of the book. Again, that's on Saturday, January 18th, from 2 until 4. Both Janice and Robin will also be at Barnes & Noble, Hamilton Place, signing copies of the book from 2 until 4 on Saturday, February 1st. For WUTC's Around and About, I'm Richard Winham.